Imagine your science professor was Indiana Jones. That's the best way I can characterize my guest today, Marc-André Myers, a distinguished professor of mechanical engineering, materials science, and nanoengineering at UC San Diego. His work ranges from the materials science of toucan beaks to mechanical metallurgy and high explosives. He's also an explorer of the Amazon jungle, speaks 5 languages, and has written 6 novels. Welcome to Molecular Podcasting. I'm your host, Darren Lapomi. I'm a professor of nanoengineering at UC San Diego. I'm a trained chemist interested in ways in which electronic materials can be made soft and tough for applications ranging from cheap, indestructible solar panels to wearable medical devices to tactile interfaces for virtual reality. This podcast, however, is not about those things or about any scientific topic in particular. Instead, it's about the people who practice science, their inspirations, and their lives and careers. So rather than being another science podcast, this is a meta-scientific or maybe peri-scientific podcast, if that makes sense. Probably doesn't, but that's fine. Professor Marc Myers is a Brazilian-born distinguished professor and senior colleague at my home institution, UC San Diego. While he has hundreds of publications and tens of thousands of citations, this conversation is principally about his life and writing career. We start out with a discussion of a recent expedition deep in the Amazon jungle in which Mark's goal was to retrace the steps of Roosevelt and Rondon, a Brazilian explorer. I hope you enjoy listening to this conversation as much as I enjoyed participating in it. So you just returned from New York City where you were giving a guest lecture at the Explorers Club. Can you tell us a little bit about that and what the topic of your talk was?
Yes. This was a momentous event in my life. It's something that only happens once. Like Andy Warhol said, we all have our 15 minutes of fame. I went there. I was invited by the Explorers Club to give a lecture on the River of Doubt, the Centennial Expedition. And this is an expedition that I organized on the centennial of the famous Roosevelt-Rondon expedition of 1913-1914, where he almost lost his life.
Okay, and how long had you been preparing for this expedition?
This came to me, the aha moment came when I closed the last page of the book by Candice Millard, The River of Doubt. I had something that told me, Mark, you have to go and repeat that expedition using approximately the same means of transportation that they used on horseback, on foot, and by canoe, and following, tracking the same territory that they tracked, but also adding to this expedition a scientific component in the same way as Roosevelt and Rondon. They had a scientific goal when they went down. They had with them naturalists, they had a geologist, they had what they call a mammalogist, which falls into the category of an ornithologist. And so they really were collecting information all along their expedition. So I wanted to keep this spirit alive.
Mm-hmm. And this ties in very well with your scientific work. So I attended a lecture of yours a few months ago, and you passed around samples, and you're well known in the scientific community for studying the microstructure of toucans' beaks and interesting biological materials. So tell us a little bit about your work, and this is almost like biological archaeology, right? So you find these materials and study them.
Yes, my scientific career actually started in a very different direction. I did my PhD with explosives, studying shock waves. I started this in 1972, and I spent, 44 years blowing things up. I did explosives. I would set up as a graduate student my own explosives. It would be unheard of nowadays. I would just go there, cut the explosives up, and accelerate flyer plates in controlled environment. Then I went to Brazil, and I went to work for the Military Institute of Engineering, and there I I was able to set up the first explosives laboratory in Latin America, collecting explosives, mounting them, assembling them, and doing some meaningful research. Then I came to the United States. I happened to be very fortunate that at the New Mexico Institute of Mining and Technology, I was there. I organized a conference on Explomet on explosives. We had a big facility there. And I continued my career on explosives, but I think that at some point I had this desire to study something different, biological, and the critical moment happened to me when I was actually a young adult. I was like 20 years. I was with my father. My father was hunting. He loved to hunt. And I was laying in a little forest, and I saw the toucans flying about my head. And so I walked around and I found this skeleton of a toucan, and I lifted the beak, and the beak was extremely light and yet tough. It resisted torsion, bending, and I was puzzled by it. And this image stayed with me for 40 years, and every now and then I would tell a graduate student, let's study it, but nobody demonstrated any interest. They were very focused on their own work. And until I got one student, Matt Schneider, he actually did some research, and we got the beak of a toucan. We purchased it here in Fallbrook and from Jerry Jennings, and we got the beak, and then we studied the beak, and it was like a tremendous success. We were in National Geographic. We were featured in the news media, and so I got excited with it, and I studied the toucan, and I also studied the abalone shells under the disguise of army funding, using as an motivation that it would be a good material that would inspire armor. And so I expanded from there into a number of materials. And then I saw this opportunity, and I used to go to Brazil. I used to fish. I am fairly familiar with the Amazon. I have gone there several times. I know the Amazon fairly well.
And you're from Brazil originally.
I am from Brazil. And so my father used to go fishing and hunting. The people from my hometown used to go fishing and hunting in the Amazon. The first time I went there, I spent 48 hours on a truck driving through the Brazilian hinterland until we arrived at the river. We actually got stuck, and we had to be pulled out by oxen. And so I went and started picking materials from the Amazon, like the scales of the arapaimas, the teeth of the piranha, and there's a seed that has unique properties, the Jarina seed. And so I found that meshing this expedition with the collection of some specimens enriched it. And so this is in line and in the spirit of the original Roosevelt expedition. And Roosevelt considered himself, and probably was in those days, he was a scientist, because he was very knowledgeable in a naturalist. Since childhood, he had dedicated himself to it. And he really emphasized in his book that he wrote about his expedition, all of the observational aspects. And he was a brilliant person, and he was actually a precursor, I would say, of sociobiology, because in some ways he expresses the view that after observing the animals, some birds, he said, most naturalists just take the bird and look at the bird in a biological way, but it would be very nice to observe these birds and animals for a long period to know their behavior in the wild. And this is something that I think was at that time not really emphasized.
Mm-hmm. And this was around the time when the term sociobiology was coined by Edward O. Wilson. And
exactly,
the famous textbook came out, and also caused quite a lot of controversy on the far political left. In the line of genetic determinism, and E.O. Wilson famously had a bucket of ice water poured on his head, which turned out to be maybe like a cup of tepid water, mm-hmm. These things tend to get blown out of proportion in history. But the idea of collecting these specimens was around in your life before the explosives research, and then you return to it now.
Yeah.
And you wrote about the
the River of Doubt expedition in your most recent book, which you published just in time to go to the Explorers Club meeting. First of many works that I will read of yours was actually over Christmas break when you were kind enough to give me a copy of Yanomami, which is a book about the Yanomami people it's a native tribe that inhabits the area between Brazil and Venezuela. And I wonder if you could tell me a little bit about the motivation for writing that book.
Yanomami, I had always have a fascination with Indians. And as a child, I would hear stories of Indians. I remember at home we had a book with pictures by a Swiss ethnographer, or he was just a Swiss adventurer called Tupari, where he actually went to an Indian village and spent several months there. And it was always a dream that I had to visit Indian tribes and to live with them and to, in a certain way, understand very simple societies and what drives very people when they live in a society that where the structure is very loose and very simple and is not so hierarchical. This is also resonates with Levi-Strauss, who actually also followed exactly the same trail as Roosevelt, as our trail. And he was in search of a society that was so simple that none of the impositions of culture or of civilization existed. So I was fascinated by that, and I made sporadic contacts with Indians. The Indian population in Brazil is very small, and I happened to fall upon a book by a famous anthropologist, Napoleon Chagnon. I don't know if my son had it in his class. I think he has it in his class, and I was fascinated by the book. And I visited Napoleon Chagnon. He was a professor in Santa Barbara. And I talked to him, and he told me about the plight of the Yanomami, how they are being invaded, their lands are being invaded, and the difficulties that they underwent. And he spent actually 6 years with them, and he studied them at great length. And his theories are also controversial. And he considers he's more of a Darwinist. So I put him as a character in this novel under disguise there. And I tried to establish contact in Brazil and tried to get permission to visit the Yanomami. And I could not get the permission. I tried very hard. I wrote actually a proposal to the Brazilian National Science Foundation. I went to the tribe right and left, and I was not able to get success. They actually thought that I was some people thought I was an American spy. There are theories that exist that the Yanomami land, there are efforts by foreign organizations that want to create a Yanomami nation that lies between Venezuela and Brazil, and that would conflict with the Brazilian boundaries. So I was not able to visit them, but my dream is not dead. I didn't visit them physically, but I visit them in spirit. And this is the book, I think, that has a little bit of their plight. Okay?
I see. And when you write about characters so vividly, you must draw inspiration from people you know in your real life. Especially, there are scientists in the book. There's an evolutionary psychologist in the book who is reminiscent of your colleague that you mentioned. How do you write characters so that your professional colleagues don't see maybe a trait in their characters that maybe they don't like and they attribute to themselves?
Well, this is a tricky situation, and I think that as I evolve in my writing, I use more and more my imagination. But my first book, Mayan Mars, I was criticized for using characters that were fairly close to real characters. But I was worried about it, but I had this editor Jennifer Redmond, and she told me, she was very encouraging. She said, and it's interesting that sometimes women have more of a sensitivity than men. And she said, and I had also some scenes, like some love scenes, and I felt were a little strong. And she said, absolutely not, Mark. They are very apropos, and I like them very much. Another thing she said is, don't worry, because if people see themselves, they will not admit to it. And if they don't see themselves, that's all right. So, but I took some risks sometimes out of maybe my own limitations, or because the characters somewhat I see around, I look around myself, and sometimes I see behavior that is interesting, that is that would fit well in a novel, and I think I incorporated it into the book. So I think that in my next novel that I'm working on, I believe that the characters are all really fictitious. But in some cases, I use I have one book on explosives, and there I base some characters on real characters that I encountered through my career in the Soviet Union and in the United States. The one on Mayan Mars are some characters that are involved in research projects, and I think that every writer has this problem a little bit. There was a writer, I heard him say that every time he finishes a book, he has to run out of his town for a couple of years, and then he comes back, okay?
So the general plot of the book is that an international mining concern finds natural resources in the vicinity of a particular tribe, particular village of this Yanomami people. Is your experience, as you mentioned before we started recording, that your father was in the steel industry, did that play into, is there some historical truth to this particular story?
Well, my father was in the steel industry. My brother is in the mining industry. So from the stories he passed on to me, and from some things that have been reported in the media, it is absolutely true that tribes were displaced in order to exploit the mines. Not only mining companies did it, but many rubber tapping companies and big ranchers, because the Brazilian law protects the Indian very much. Rondon, who was the companion of Roosevelt in this expedition, he created the Brazilian Foundation for Protection of the Indian. And if there is an Indian territory where or there are Indian tribes in a certain region, this region cannot be exploited. So the most convenient way is to get rid of the Indians. And this has been done in Brazil, unfortunately, throughout the Brazilian history, many times, and the Indians were the great losers in this large economic expansion of Brazil. Mm-hmm.
And I should point out that the characters, as they appear at first, are not the way that they end up being in the book. So while there are some archetypes, there's much more that meets the eye to these characters, which is what I love about the book. Your protagonist is a strong female character. She's an undergraduate at Berkeley, and I wonder if there's if you've tapped into the vein of popular action adventure fiction that features female characters prominently, like the two most recent Star Wars movies and the Hunger Games. Did this occur to you, or you just always wanted to have a strong female lead?
Yes, I think it occurred to me, and I enjoyed it, so I had created all these shady characters that were men, you know, so I thought I'll have a redeeming somebody with redeeming values, and I made her a woman. in her case, I based her a little bit on my daughter. My daughter, so she knows about it. But I took some of the things when I describe her or some of her quirks, I took from my daughter. So it is. I used her dog. She has a dog called Tonto, and my daughter has had a dog called Tonto. She didn't go to Berkeley, but she was a little bit of a radical like this. And so one goes through a novel, and at the beginning, what happens is that one has to establish a structure or start writing, and then, but from a certain point on, the novel, the characters develop their own life, and you are almost writing down what the things that they are doing, and then the new protagonists come into play as if we were walking in a place, and we meet these different people. They all somewhat, they appear somehow mysteriously.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And would you say that you've had formal training in fiction writing?
No, I did not. I had a little bit. I was, when I was a teenager, I started writing little things, one page long, little compositions when I was 12. And I was encouraged by my mentor, who was Padre Henriquez. But Padre Henriquez was very rigid grammatically. He really had a very, very, it's like grammar was like mathematics for him. He was unforgiving in any grammatical mistake. He would give you, if you had any grammatical mistake, you get a zero. But he didn't really teach the structure of writing and other things. But I did a lot of reading, and there was always in me a desire to write. So I actually asked my father when I started writing poems, I believe I was 12 or 13. And I would collect them. I had a little red puffy book, and I would write them down and keep them. And I always had this desire to join some intellectual groups, but I never did it. I was not courageous enough, not bold enough to do it. And I got into engineering, and when I got into engineering and I served in the Brazilian Army, ROTC, there was so much burden on me that I really kind of pushed back the writing. So when I was in the senior year, I collected all these little poems that I have. There's not great poetry. I'm not a Neruda, but I collected them, and I published them in the print plant of the university. And without me knowing, the censors went through it. They took it, and the president of the university called me in, and he said, "We are in trouble," he said. "The military have taken hold of your book. You wrote some things that are a little bit insulting to them, and they want to question you." So, and I had applied at that time to a Fulbright scholarship, and I was a finalist to the Fulbright. I was going to get it. I was sure I was going to get it. I was very happy, and I had developed an interest in anthropology at that time. And but then the thing is that I forfeited even my graduation from college. I said I'd better get out of the country as soon as possible before they... And I went and I actually talked to the military, and they said, "No, if we open an investigation, you cannot leave the country. As long as the investigation lasts, it could last 2-3 years. So I took off, and I didn't tell my parents this. My parents were upset because I didn't go to graduation, but I left and then came to the University of Colorado where my brother was studying. And then I crossed over to the University of Denver, and then they gave me an assistantship, and that's how I started my graduate career.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Would you say that writing, I think of academic research, even in the sciences and engineering, as to a zeroth order approximation, you're a writer anyway.
Because that is true.
You're publishing sometimes.
That's right. We are writing all the time.
Tens of thousands
all day
of
long.
Words per year. And it's tends to be polished, you know, prose too. You don't want to submit to a journal if it has errors in it. How much of the confidence that you have now as a author of fiction did you derive from writing papers and scholarly books and articles?
Well, There's a craft of writing fiction. There's a craft, and I took a class with Mike Sirota here at UCSD, how to make your novel better, how to make a good novel better. So, and then I hired him as an editor for, I believe, one of the books, and then he worked on my text a lot, and he actually showed me a lot of things, like dialogue. I still am very bad in dialogue. English is not my native language, but I struggle with it, and it's gotten better. How to have the point of view, different points of view, how you switch from one point of view to another one. These are the technical aspects. I think that there's a tremendous amount in common. I always say that, as a joke, that many of my colleagues write fiction, scientific fiction, and they claim it's real. And I see so many papers that make claims that are beyond the reality. And so they use imagination, they use some experiments, and then they write a story. So there's a lot in common, yes. And you have to go through many drafts. I think when I write something, it's lousy, it's horrible. And then you gradually work it and work it and work it until it becomes acceptable, and then you work on it more until it becomes good. So that polishing of a manuscript is an essential part.
I see. And when you write, do you seek a sabbatical from the department and the university, or you work nights and weekends? How do you make time?
I don't seek a sabbatical. I think I sought a sabbatical for my technical writing for this book, Biological Material Science, that I spent 2 months in Cambridge, and I worked day and night on it and got it done, and together with Po Yu Chen. But on this writing, what I did is I have a mission in my life. I think I have an obligation to write. I feel that's the case. I feel an obligation, and this is what I felt when I wrote my Implosion Abscission. I said, well, I have to do it. That's something that I promised myself when I was a child to do it. And now, if I don't do it now, I'll never do it. So I kind of I push myself, and I have a manuscript of a novel at home. It's all ready, and I send it to the San Diego Book Awards. It actually was a finalist, but I need to get to it. It's there, sitting there. I think the most difficult part, I think, is once you get the story down, you get the story. I sometimes stay in the morning. I write for 1 hour, and I cannot write for 8 hours either, because one writes and then one has to, the batteries have to be recharged. One runs out of material to write. So I think that the writing process, the getting the story together is the complex part. Writing it down, one can write 500 words a day, so a book is 80,000 words. You can do it in 160 days. If you sit down for 1 hour a day, you can do it in a few months. So I just do it at home. And then the process of rewriting, that's what takes a lot of time.
Yeah. What time of day do you accomplish your most creative work?
Yeah, when I was a kid, when I was young, I was a night person. I would write that. But I abandoned all writing when I was 22. For many years, I didn't write. I actually went to the Amazon when I was 22, and I spent 2 months in the Purus River, and I wrote a diary there. I wrote a lot. I wrote a dictionary of an Indian tribe, and I wrote all of my observations, and then I was going to publish them, and then I arrived in Denver. They stole my suitcase in the airport, and my whole manuscript was, I didn't have a single, I only had one single copy, okay? And then I focused on writing textbook. I wrote a textbook in Brazil, Mechanical Metallurgy. I translated it to English and became Mechanical Metallurgy, and then it evolved into mechanical behavior. So I focused mainly on the technical writing, and I think the discipline of technical writing helped me a lot to work through a novel, because that discipline it's like you have to take a class, you have to prepare a class, you have to write these things down. So the same way in a book, you have to write it down, you have to get it down on paper, see, whether you are inspired or not. I don't wait for inspiration, I just grind through it, through pain or through days of inspiration. Some days are lousy, but then it hopefully gradually works, comes together, yeah.
So you mentioned that English is not your native language and that you're from Brazil originally, but you speak other languages beyond Portuguese, yeah, and English. And how did you come to learn these languages, and why, and how often do you speak them?
Well, I'm in a very fortunate situation. My parents are from Luxembourg. And Luxembourg, there are two national languages in Luxembourg, French and German. Actually, French is the official language. German is the what people speak. They speak a German dialect, Luxembourgish. So we lived in Luxembourg when I was 7 to 8 years old, and I didn't know a single word when I came to Luxembourg. My father was not, he was, in this respect, he was very simple. He just put us in a school, the village school. I was a village school. There were kids from the first year to all the, to the 8th year, 8 years of school, and one teacher, driving the teacher crazy. So they put me there, and I, for 2 months, and then I went to the city of Luxembourg. There I had my regular classroom, and I think I struggled. I was studying two languages at the same time, French and German. The German was horrible for me, but French is very easy because it's a Latin language. So, and then we returned to Brazil, and we had French and English in school, and but French, I became very good, and then I went when I was 18 years of age, 17, I spent a year in Belgium, and I did the Alliance Française, which is exists here too. I did the 5th year of Alliance Française, and then I actually was in the literary section 6, 7 years, but then other priorities took hold of me. And my friends were all going out that night, drinking beer and having fun, and I was there studying French. So I didn't pursue the literary French, but French I would consider my second language. And then English was my third. And then German, I am very rusty at German, would be my fourth language. Okay. Mm-hmm.
Were you ever concerned, or did you ever come across a situation where other scientists and academics saw that you were doing so much work in exploration and writing, and they said, "Well, your career, your scientific career is going to take a hit by devoting energy outside," or is it something where you've paid your dues and it doesn't matter?
I think that I think at this stage I paid my dues. I as I say in my book, I jumped over the hurdles that comprise our profession, and I jumped over the hoops, right? And I did not really advertise my writing. I would write my poetry. I never told anybody I was writing. And I think that the reaction of my colleagues is very interesting. Some people they think it's some people think it's interesting. Some people don't even mention it, as if I had never written. It's like anathema. So I get these different reactions. I'm pursuing my goal, and I attribute it to a certain part of me. My maternal grandmother she wrote very well, and she wrote poetry. Madeleine was her name, and I have a little story that my mother used to say that she wrote beautifully, and that they had found some gold coins or some coins in their fields, a big amphora, and it was a Roman coin. So they took them home and they said, "Well, this belonged to the Grand Duke, Grand Duchess. We cannot keep these things." So they went and sent them to the Grand Duke. And then one day my mother actually was standing at home, and my aunt my grandmother wrote a letter. And one day there was this carriage comes into the farm, and then my mother runs to the door, opens the door, and she sees this beautiful dressed gentleman. And then when my grandmother comes, she was wearing an apron. She said, "Oh my God, you are the Prince Felix. You came because of the coins." And he said, "No, madam, I came because of the beautiful letter that you wrote." And I wanted to thank you. So, and she loved to write, and she lived in the countryside, and she had this talent. She would write poetry, and she would write poetry and send it to the other girls in the classroom. And I think this is kind of this literary talent maybe it resides within a person, because my father's family, my father is an engineer, my grandfather was an engineer, and then what were they before? They made wine, and they grew wine, and then there were some people that were business people, merchants. So on my father's side, there is nobody who enjoyed, right? But my mother's side may be a little more bohemian. Mm-hmm. So maybe I inherited a little bit of that. And I feel it's an obligation. I have to put it on paper, because there's so many things in our mind that happen in our mind, and we think about them and they exist and then they dissolve away. And I tried to write a novel when I was 20, and I wrote and I wrote and I wrote in my room, and I put it there on top of a closet. And then when I came to the United States, I think the maids were cleaning, and then they threw the whole thing away. So
well, you've lost a lot of pages. I've lost a lot of work.
So I cannot afford to lose anymore. Yeah. See, so and I didn't tell anybody, because I was doing it in secret. And I remember the name of the novel. It was called Circles. Circles, two concentric circles. It had to do with the Brazilian hinterland. It had to do with Indians. So. And this was totally lost, but anyway, I persevered. Okay, and that's the engineering quality.
Mm-hmm. And it's quite unusual for an engineering, a professional engineer, to write fiction and to popularize, yeah. Work compared to biologists, yeah. Who seem to do this quite.
Yeah,
often
doctors, medical doctors write a lot too, but very few engineers.
Mm-hmm.
And I was in Brazil. I went there, and they had the first World Congress of engineer writers, and they invited me. So I went there and I gave a talk, and there were like 30 of us that were. Brazil has a very famous writer that is an engineer. He's considered one of the Brazilian heroes, Euclides da Cunha, and he was an engineer, and. And he wrote a book called Os Sertões, and this is considered a classic in Brazilian literature. And then he proceeded to get killed very young. So I think that.
Very few chemists, too.
Very few chemists, really?
It seems to be something that biologists and cosmologists.
Yeah, that is right. They have a broader vision. Medical doctors, because they deal with patients, with feelings, with sentiments, with tragedy, and they write. Military people write too about their mm-hmm. adventures. Yeah.
Have you ever been tempted to write about a fictional material scientist?
I have two here. I have two. In Mayan Mars, there is one guy called Gustavo Chen, and he's a material scientist. And he worked on materials. Yes, he worked on materials. And then in the other book, in Chechnya Jihad, I have one called Jean-Claude Delvaux, and he is also a material scientist, an explosives expert. And then he discovers a very powerful, super powerful explosive, and this is the beginning of the novel. Okay.
Well, you're way ahead of my question then. So the moment I knew that I wanted to have you as my first guest for this podcast was during a department meeting on the beach in San Diego. We can do that, where we had a conversation over coffee and yogurt parfait, where I told you that I was interested in writing fiction myself. And that I was inspired by Aldous Huxley, and not necessarily Brave New World, which everyone knows, but the earlier work, like Chrome Yellow in the English Country House. And I had just finished rereading it. I had read it when I was 19, I think, mm-hmm. and I'm going back through them in 15-year mm-hmm. increments. And I had mentioned Chrome Yellow, and it was a book that's so obscure that when you order it on Amazon, they print it for you on demand, and it comes with a date in it mm-hmm. that said, August 28th, 2016. And you told me I read that quite recently, and I knew that we spoke the same language, so to speak.
You are much more methodical probably than I am. My reading has been, I am a little bit what they call omnivorous. This Chrome Yellow, for instance, I was at Clare Hall in Cambridge, where I go, where I usually stay in Clare Hall, and I found it there, and I was looking for something, and I looked, and there it's sitting there, and I grabbed it immediately, took it to my room, and read it, you see. And so I should be more methodical in my writing. I try to be methodical. I try to read, and then to analyze and to write a little review. I have a little book where I keep my reviews, and then I go also to the Amazon, and then I write a review and put it on the Amazon. That's kind of a discipline to myself, but I don't always do it. And I think that's that reading, when you write, you read, and you have to be, you can read much more critically, and then you can maybe take some things that you can use, increase your vocabulary, improve your style, and so I think throughout my life, I was not guided by anybody. I was kind of like at home. There were some books, and I would pick up books, and I would go to Monlevadji, and often my buddies, they were out. I was reading at night, and I took an interest at some time in the last year of engineering for anthropology. So I gathered all the books, and my colleague, my friends, my buddies, they would go out drinking, chasing girls. That was the thing, and driving fast cars. And I was there reading. So I think in this respect, I was a little bit different from them. Okay, maybe they had a happier youth than I.
Do you have particular favorite authors that you look to for inspiration or writing styles even?
I would read when I was young in Brazil. I remember when I was 10, 11, I read all of Edgar Rice Burroughs' Tarzan books and things like this, but these are kind of young adults. Then I started reading Brazilian authors, José de Alencar, Machado de Assis. Then there was a Brazilian author that nobody knows here, but it's called Guimarães Rosa. He only wrote two books. He was a doctor, and his book is a masterpiece. Then I read Hemingway, of course, Fitzgerald. At a certain point, I read. I read the non-fiction books. Hermann Hesse. I went through all his books. Of course, Aldous Huxley, Brave New World. But I don't. Dostoevsky when I was in college. I read Dostoevsky. So, and none of my engineering colleagues were interested in reading this, so I didn't even have anybody to converse with, you see. So it was a little bit, I felt, I was afraid because it gave me fear, because when the more I read, and I would enter into an imaginary world, and I would go into this world, and I would go deeply into it, and then I would, and I could not get out of it, and get back into reality would be for me a shock. And I had difficulty with reality, and I preferred being in this virtual world. Mm-hmm. But I was able to get out and finish my engineering studies, get on with life. My father actually said, "Dad, I want to become a writer." He actually got me in touch with a journalist, and he said the best way to become a good writer is you become a journalist. You write, and then he got me in touch with a journalist, and I did translation. So the guy was not very inspiring character, but he asked me to translate articles from French to Portuguese for him. So I would do this. I would go there as a volunteer, and then he would then publish them in the Brazilian newspaper, and it kind of got me mad, because he would just put himself as author. So that's the first instance I was exposed to plagiarism. And he had all these articles. He would give me these very complicated Cahiers du Cinéma, I don't know, some other Le Monde, and I had to change, to translate them. I would give them to him, and then the next day the thing would come out with his name. But my father said, become an engineer, my son. Study engineering, you can always write later. And he said, and my mother used to say that you cannot write right now, she said, because you don't have any experience of life. You need experience of life to write, which I don't agree necessarily. I think that many writers, they wrote when they were very young. You write about your experiences when you're young, you see. But in my case, it came late, you see. And so I struggle a lot with writing. I think that if I had dedicated myself fully to writing, maybe I would have become a better writer.
It's interesting that you mentioned journalism and translation, because you have a deadline and there can't be a writer's block, because
that is right. You have to do it. Get it out. So many words.
And in some sense, scientific writing as well, because you have a deadline for an article. So what are your next literary projects and adventures and perhaps research projects?
Okay. So in research, I got into this biological research, and I tell jokingly to my friends that in the end of the day, I'll be known for the biological work and not for the explosives work. They get very mad at me. But anyway, I think that the repercussion of this work is great. Biological and bio-inspired materials. Everybody's talking about it. You publish a paper, the news media just picks up on it. The most childish thing is taken, and because people relate to it. I think people relate to it. People don't relate to the mathematical aspects of propagation of a shockwave and generation of defects in the material. Who cares, you see?
But we all know who Toucan Sam is.
Yeah, we know what Toucan Sam is. We know the abalone shells, the hair. I published a paper on hair now, and they are saying that they wrote several articles on it on the news about hair, that hair is going to be the next armor, and they show these beautiful ladies with blonde hair, and then that's the headline. They're kind of making fun of it too. But anyway, I think I'll continue this area of biology. I have three areas, actually. I have nanocrystalline metals, extreme deformation and failure of material, extreme behavior of materials, and the third one is biological and bio-inspired materials. So I plan to continue, until the sunset with these, or at least three areas, if I can get funding. That's a big challenge too. And then literary, I wrote a novel called Our Lady of the Squids, and it's ready, it's sitting there, and I think it's a good novel. It's a little bit in the style of magic realism. It has some elements of magic realism, and I'm developing my style in a sense that Mike Sirota, my editor, who also is author of several books, he was disciplining my style, my sentences to be short and to the point and cut down. But then I decided, well, I am a Latin American writer. I'm a South American writer. I am a little different, you see. I don't have to fit into this template. So now I'm kind of developing my own style. I let my imagination flow and at the same time have a plot that people can read and follow. So this, I think, this novel is it's a very interesting novel. It's about the squids, you see, in Baja, and I traveled to Baja many times, and it's about squids, and it's about the squid. So there's where the magic realism comes in. These squids, there are giant squids on the beach, and this woman is ravaged by a squid, you see. And then 9 months later, a little girl is born, and then it's the story of this little girl and the redemption of the sea, the pollution of the sea, the destruction of the sea, and this girl will be the redeemer of the oceans. Okay, that's why she's Our Lady of the Squids, you see. Mm-hmm. And I also have in the meantime, as a background, the narco wars are raging, you see, and there's a lot of fighting and things like this. And then I put a character in from Carlos Fuentes. It's called, there's a man called The Old Gringo. I don't know if you've heard of this novel. The Old Gringo. It's a beautiful novel. It's about an old American. It's a true story. He goes into Mexico. He's like 70 years of age. He's old. And he rides his horse across the Rio Grande. And he goes to Mexico. And he joins the revolutionary forces. And he came to Mexico to die, you know, because he's old and he's abandoning. So I put one of his characters is an old gringo. So I put him in there, and he's. So I think it's a good novel. It needs to be worked on, but the difficulty is to find an agent and find nowadays very, very difficult. Mm-hmm. So I enjoy the process of writing, but the process of finding agents is extremely difficult and complex, especially since I don't have I tried many agents and. I just publish with the small publishers and with a smaller market, and I'm happy with that. Okay? Mm-hmm. Content with that. Okay.
Terrific. How about adventures? Not necessarily on the level of River of Doubt,
Okay, River of Doubt. Adventures. I joined the Explorers Club. I have this little thing here. They gave it to me. And so the Explorers Club is a wonderful organization, and they have actual flag expeditions. You can actually join the expeditions, and this one on the River of Doubt, we did not finish the last part. That's the easy part. We still want to do that. But I would like to go, the next goal would be to go, I would like to go to the Yanomami and spend some time with the Yanomami. And I want to have an excuse. I want to measure the velocity at which they shoot arrows and the accuracy, because in another generation, they will use guns, and that will have completely disappeared. So if I can get the technical tools to do it, measure the velocity, determine accuracy. So I will try to work with the Brazilian officials. It's a long process of getting permission. It's bureaucratically very complex. But I was able to get it for this. I was able to get the proposal in, and with two Brazilian officers, we submitted the proposal. We had to get shots. We had to get permissions. We had to get a tremendous amount of documentation is required, you see, by the Brazilian foundation. And I think it's good, because not everybody should go in there, okay?
Mm-hmm. So before we wrap up, I wonder if you could tell our audience where they can learn more about you, where they can get your books.
I have a site, markmyers.org, M-A-R-C, myers.org. And also you just go in Amazon, and all my books are listed on Amazon.
Okay, terrific. And thank you so much for your time.
Well, I have to thank you, okay? It's a great pleasure.
There you have it. Thanks to Mark again for his time. If you'd like to hear more conversations like these, please subscribe to the podcast and share it on social media. If you'd like to learn more about my work, my research group's website can be found at group.darrenlapomi.com. My YouTube channel, Facebook page, and Twitter feed can all be found under my name, Darren Lapomi. That's D-A-R-R-E-N-L-I-P-O-M-I. Finally, I'd like to give credit to my brother-in-law, John Viviani, for letting me use his music. This track is titled The Real You by Filthy Funk, which consists of John on guitar and bass, Nick Murray on keys, Jervon Trammell on drums, and Daniel Ponder on vocals. Thanks very much for listening. See you next time on Molecular Podcasting. You might believe